And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Nathan Hill to the program today. Nathan has worked as a journalist and is currently on leave from his job as an associate professor of creative writing. He's just published his debut novel, The Nix, to much critical acclaim, including starred reviews in Publishers Weekly, Booklist, and Kirkus. And it was recently announced that Meryl Streep and J.J. Abrams plan on adapting The Nix for television. Nathan, as The Nix opens, Faye Anderson Anderson is leaving her husband and Samuel in 1988. And then 23 years later, we have Samuel as an English professor, and he's never recovered from that loss of his mother.
Yeah, I wanted my character to be in sort of bad shape at the beginning of the book, you know. He needs to be able to go places, you know, as the book progresses. So, yeah, he never really recovers this wound. It's sort of this invisible wound that he never really lets out, that he never really talks about. He tries not to think about, but it's there, kind of deep inside him. And then some things happen at the beginning of the book that cause that wound to sort of break free again, and that's what begins the action of the novel.
Her name is unusual, Andressen Anderson. Why make it so purposefully confusing?
I wish there were a real high-minded reason for it. I mostly just thought it was funny. Andressen is a Norwegian name that comes from my family. I have a grandmother a few generations back whose name was Andressen, and I remember doing a family tree when I was like in second or third grade, and my teacher insisted that I misspelled Anderson as Andressen, and I checked with my parents and they said no, I was right, and so I don't know, that stuck with me all these years later, that the confusion between those two names I thought would just be pretty funny.
And a little bit of told you so back to your
right,
elementary
exactly.
school teacher. Among his many problems he has, the main action of the story takes place in 2011. He's had a contract to write a novel for about a decade now, and things are just not going well at all.
Yeah, he never really reached his potential. You know, he had this book contract, got paid a lot of money, and then he just never wrote the book. So instead, he's teaching university students how to write essays on Hamlet. And he really, really dislikes it. He resents his lack of success. He resents his job. He resents his students. And his students are naturally pretty sour right back at him. And he spends most of his days playing video games. He plays this game called World of Elfscape, which is my ripoff of the video game World of Warcraft. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with this game, but it's called a massively multiplayer online video game. It's, you know, thousands of people get together online and their avatars go slay dragons and orcs and this type of thing.
You build up little teams called guilds.
Yeah, exactly. He's on a guild, and this is what he does most of the time now. He's not really pleased with what's going on in his life, but at least he can be good at ElfQuest. But then, of course, he has a love-hate relationship with ElfQuest because he realizes that he's doing it much more than, say, writing a book.
So did you play and try to justify it as research for the book?
I did play. I knew it wasn't research at the time. That maybe, you know, I can erase history a little bit and scrub out my own guilt. But yeah, I did play World of Warcraft for a few years. And I had the same love-hate relationship with that game that Samuel has in the novel. On the one hand, it helped me through a pretty hard, dark time in my own life. You know, I met a lot of great people, and for the most part, people play this game very socially and very in a very healthy manner. Like, you know, people play with their spouses, their boyfriends and girlfriends, their children. I met a woman playing ElfQuest who was a grandmother who played with her grandchildren because they live far apart, and that's how they could connect. So, you know, people can use this game in a really healthy way, but then other people might not use it. They might be a more problematic gamer, and that might have been me. I might have been close to it. I remember, like, you know, saying no to social events because I had a raid with my guild, you know, and so eventually I had to quit the game cold turkey. It was taking a little too much of my time, but because my feelings toward the game were so ambivalent, I liked it and hated it simultaneously. I thought it was good material for the novel.
And there is a character who has a very unhealthy relationship with the game, and he goes by Pwnage.
Pwnage, yeah. Do you know this word, pwn?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, all right. If your listeners don't, pwn is spelled P-W-N. The way the legend goes is in the early days of online gaming, if I were to beat somebody really badly at a game, I might type, "I just owned you." Of course, the P key is next to the O key on all the keyboards, and so a lot of people misspelled own as P-W-N or pwn. And then the internet being the internet, the typo just sort of caught on. So PWN, pwn, is a verb meaning to defeat someone utterly in a video game. So yeah, this guy plays World of Elfscape, and we only know him through his video game avatar's name, Pwnage.
And as competent and impressive as he is in the online world, AFK, away from keyboard, he is...
You know the lingo.
I watched that Pirate Bay documentary.
Yeah, all right, all right.
His personal life is just falling apart, even worse than Samuel's.
Than Samuel's, yeah, indeed. I wanted to show a sort of limit test of what could happen if Samuel kept going down this road that might end at Pwnage. Pwnage, he has big dreams of writing a mystery novel and renovating his kitchen and starting a radical new diet and eating healthy for the first time, cutting back on his video game playing and winning back his ex-wife. But all that stuff is hard work. And on a day-to-day basis, when it really comes down to it, and those little decisions that you have to make every day about whether you're going to do the hard thing or the easy thing, he picks the easy thing, World of Elfscape, and he fires up the computer and promises himself he'll do all those other things later. It's a magnified phenomenon that I think happens to all of us. It certainly happens to me. When I think of myself in the future, I think of myself as maybe a better person than I really am. You know, like I'll get a gym membership and then not use it. I'll load up my Netflix queue with like really heavy, deep Oscar winners. And then on any given night, I'll watch, I don't know, another Marvel comic book movie or something like that.
Or Werewolf Cop.
Or Werewolf Cop, right? So yeah, when we think of ourselves in the future, we think that we're going to be really great people, but it's actually hard to get there. It's, you know, you have to make a lot of everyday small tough choices to actually become that person that you want to be. And I know I was feeling that, and so I poured a lot of that into Pwnage.
You say he does the easy thing, but he's got multiple accounts, like five or six accounts. Yeah. He has to do these repetitive raids over and over every day for a daily quest. And it's like a person with a drug addiction or something, going out, acquiring the drugs and everything. That's difficult.
That's true.
To do all that.
I think I describe him as Elfscape genius. He's really great at it, and he plays it, this technique called multi-boxing, where he's playing like five or six characters at a time. Like playing one is hard, but five or six is just incredible. It's the place where he finds really deep meaning in his life. He doesn't have that source of meaning elsewhere. He had a job that he didn't really like at a copy shop, and then he was laid off because of the recession. So he's unemployed right now. He's having trouble finding a new job. His wife has divorced him. And so his life is sort of out of control. But he can be excellent at this one thing. And this one thing gives him a lot of meaning, both personal and social. Everybody else in his guild worships him. He's the most famous player on his server. He has a reputation. And so in some ways, like, he keeps going back to it, regardless of how difficult it is to play the way he plays. He keeps going back to it because he finds a lot of intrinsic meaning there.
And validation.
Yeah, exactly. Validation.
Very few literary novels have made video games a part of their world, and they are so important to our everyday world in America and in so many other countries. How do you think people have received this, and do they think it's like a valid form of investigation for a literary novel and blah, blah, blah?
So far, so good. Yeah, I recognize that there weren't very many books that dealt with this subject when I was writing about this subject. I wanted to see how other writers approached it. So I went out and found the novels that were sort of about video games. They were very good books, but they didn't really help. I think of Ernest Cline's Ready Player One. Mm-hmm. A great novel, but the video game in that novel is more kind of a virtual reality. So it can be described as if you're actually in that world. You know, I wanted to describe someone actually playing a video game. And I knew that maybe the only thing more boring than watching someone else play a video game that you don't understand is reading about someone else playing a video game that you don't understand. So I was looking for a lot of model or any model I could find and really didn't find it. So that was intimidating, but also really exciting. You know, I could maybe break some ground here. So, and in terms of the reception, I think it's been pretty great. I'm on my book tour right now. I'm about 3 weeks into it. And every stop I make, somebody comes up to me afterwards saying that they're a gamer and they appreciated the depiction of gaming and that they finally got to read about something that they're very familiar with, that they haven't been able to read about before.
Writing about someone playing a game is kind of like a brokered experience. Mm-hmm. And you start off the book with a brokered experience with a story from the Buddha in which the king asks several blind men to feel an elephant and describe what they have said from there. And so much of the action of the book is like that parable in which people have limited information and then they start making bad choices and assumptions based on that very limited information they have.
That's exactly right. I think I might just steal that to describe the book from now on. That was really good. I really wanted to upset people's first impressions. Anytime you meet a character in the book, I assume that people will have a snap judgment about that character. And then if they really open the hood on their lives, they'll realize there's something else going on entirely. My thinking about that came from a couple different places. I was a newspaper journalist for a few years before going to grad school for creative writing. You know, I tried my best to write the story as it seemed true to me, but not everything can fit into the newspaper. And sometimes you're told like off the record stuff that you know is true, but you can't report it. And then you have competing versions of the truth where one person tells you one thing, somebody else tells you something else, and you try to weigh that. You know, I would report it as best I could in the newspaper, but I always knew kind of inside that there was more to it than the 800 words that I could fit into the newspaper column. And so that leaked into the novel as well. That begins with this viral video of a woman throwing rocks at a presidential candidate. Everybody has a snap judgment about that, but that snap judgment turns out to be just radically wrong.
This candidate in question is former governor of Arizona, wasn't it?
Wyoming.
Yeah. And if it weren't for that official title he's had before, his attitude is very similar to one Mr. Donald J. Trump.
I was wondering if you're going to mention that. It's funny. A lot of people have said exactly that. He is a very, very far-right conservative candidate, very anti-immigrant. The funny thing is, I wrote that first scene with that particular character. I wrote that 8 years ago. And so that people are saying that it must have been reflecting our current political season just seems... I just wanted to write something kind of absurd. And so that people are finding it familiar. It's just one of those, you know, instances of reality being stranger than fiction.
Nativism hasn't been missing from our political discourse, so to think that someone could rise up to some level is not out of the question.
That's right. I was just kind of looking at certain currents in the culture 8 years ago and amplifying them a little bit.
He could easily be a stand-in for Sarah Palin.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, Samuel is procrastinating and procrastinating, and so much so with the Elfscape that he doesn't hear about this big event that's happened with a woman throwing the stones.
Yeah, he gets a phone call from his mother's lawyer saying, will you help us, you know, write a letter to the judge attesting to your mother's character so she doesn't get 20 years in prison for assaulting a presidential candidate? And he has no idea what the lawyer's talking about. So he has to sort of get caught up. Yeah, he missed it because he was raiding with Pwnage. He was with his guild killing a dragon.
And it's been 23 years since he's seen his mother. She never said a word to him as she left and hasn't heard from her since.
That's right. And so when he now has the opportunity to meet her again so quickly, he kind of doesn't know what to do about it. You know, he's been daydreaming about this moment for 2 decades. But all of a sudden, surprisingly, shockingly, it's here. He goes and meets with her, and it doesn't go very well. And maybe that's to be expected. You know, it doesn't go very well. Just at the moment he thought that they might come back together again, like they shoot farther apart.
Well, he doesn't want to meet with her when it first starts, but then he gets a call from his editor.
Yeah.
And he has external complications.
Well, yeah. So you know, I mentioned earlier that he had this book deal a long time ago that he never wrote the book for. And finally, the publisher comes calling and says, we're going to need our money back. He doesn't have that money anymore. And so they're going to have to sue him. So his options are essentially declare bankruptcy and move to Jakarta or something like that. Or the other option is to write an expose, a tell-all about his mother to capitalize on her brief internet fame. And so he chooses the latter. And so it's not only a way to get out of his book contract and avoid getting sued by his publisher, but it's also a way to sort of exact a little bit of revenge on his mom. If he can savage her publicly in this book, then he gets back at her for having left him so long ago.
It's interesting that over the course of the book, we have several different time periods in play. But his father, even though he's his sole parent after the mother leaves, we really don't know much about their relationship over the years.
Not really. That was the one question that my own father had after he finished reading the book was, what happened to Henry? What happened to the dad? I was like, sorry, Dad, it's not really Henry's story. You know, Henry's there, he raised Samuel, but really this is a story about Samuel and his mom and how far apart they are and whether they can get back together, whether they can heal that invisible wound that each of them has.
you'd mentioned that his teaching career isn't going well, and he has a student named Laura Potsdam who comes in to have a meeting about a paper. She's plagiarized, and she could be a politician herself. Deny, deny, deny.
Yeah, that chapter is written as a series of 16 logical fallacies, where each one of them is an argument that Laura tries to make to get out of failing this class. Because, yes, she's not only cheated on this one paper, she has cheated on every big assignment in college so far. That was a reflection of some frustrations I was feeling myself when I was a teacher. So for 9 or 10 years, I taught university writing, some creative writing, but also mostly freshman composition. So classes on, you know, how to write an essay in college. I should say that most students were, you know, hardworking and wonderful, but I had enough Laura Potsdams in my various classes that I started thinking something was really wrong. Like, I had so many students cheating on essays, skipping a lot of classes, not doing the assigned readings, and then complaining that, you know, a six-page reading was just way too long and just ridiculous amount of homework to assign. I would talk to my colleagues about it, and they were having the same horror stories. It made us think like something was generationally wrong or something. So I put a lot of that into the book. Laura is sort of an amalgam of maybe 15 interactions with students over the years that left me frustrated. But I think I wrote her in the beginning to maybe poke a little fun, and she was sort of, you know, a straw man, I guess. And then
to have your own logical fallacy.
Yeah, there. Exactly. And then you know, you start spending time with these characters and you kind of can't help but sort of start to love them a little bit. And so I started asking questions about Laura, like what's going on in her family? What's going on in her personal life? Why would she feel it's right to cheat on everything? What has driven her to this place? And the more of those questions I tried to answer, the more I felt sympathy for her. So now, yeah, I think she's one of my favorite characters in the book, and I think she's easily the smartest character in the book.
Well, she at least gets things done.
She does. She's maybe the only one.
But like so many of the other characters in the book, she has a very difficult time sustaining long-term relationships with other people, not just romantic relationships, but friendships as well.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. A lot of the folks in the book are making pretty bad decisions regarding kind of the people, the important people in their lives. Somewhere in the book, I equate it with a Choose Your Own Adventure novel, or reading a Choose Your Own Adventure. These were books that I loved when I was a kid, you know, those old Bantam books with the white and red spines. I would eat them up. And one thing I always did was I would put my thumb in the book when I had to make a decision. It said, you know, if you wanted to do this, turn to page whatever. And I would turn to that page and read a little bit and see if that was the right choice. And if it wasn't, I would go back to where my thumb was and pick the other choice. And a lot of these characters sort of are at this point where they've made certain decisions and they just wish that life operated in the same manner. You know, they wish that they could have put a thumb in a certain decision and go back and do the other thing. But of course, life doesn't work that way, and so they can't. And so ultimately, they're kind of stuck. I mean, they're not making really any decisions at all and kind of regretting the things that they've done in the past.
You do have that section of the book that is structured like a Choose Your Own Adventure, and it's pretty much the centerpiece of the book.
Yeah, it's an embedded Choose Your Own Adventure inside the book. It's, well, I don't know, 60 pages or something like that, and it occurs when Samuel has this big pivot point in his life. He goes to New York City to try to win the heart of the girl he's been in love with for years, and he's looking back on it thinking, if I could just make the right choices, I can get the girl. And so it's set up as sort of a Choose Your Own Adventure where he's faced with certain choices. But of course, in my writing of it, you don't actually get any choices. It's just turn the page, turn the page, turn the page, until the very end where you're presented with a doozy of a choice. And so that's meant to sort of mimic his own thinking. We think that it's a matter of like making the right choice and saying the right things, but in the moment, it sometimes feels inevitable, like you're just kind of going along with the current. And that's what he's doing. He's kind of going along with it until the end of that chapter when he has to actually finally make a big choice.
So many of the choices made in the book, am I making the right choice that is morally right, or am I making the best choice for myself?
Yeah. Yeah, everybody's faced with those things too, right? Samuel is, Faye is a couple times, Faye's father is, you know. So it's about people who have made the wrong choice, perhaps, ethically or personally. They've perhaps made the wrong choice. And so how do you live with that? It's something I was really thinking about, because when I was writing this novel, I was afraid that I had, you know, totally screwed up my own life. I decided to be a writer, and that wasn't going very well at all, and I was just thinking, what am I doing? You know, how do you live with that? How do you live with the irrevocable choices that you've made in your life? That's sort of what all these characters are bumping up against.
Going back to Laura Potsdam, the student who's plagiarized, I just thought of her name being like the Potsdam Conference. And it was this horrific meeting that had such far-reaching repercussions for Europe for the next 40 years after the war. And it was such a horrific meeting between Samuel and her that had repercussions.
You know, I'm going to pretend that I did that on purpose. I'll just take that.
Now, we flash back to the current action, as we said, 2011. We go back to Samuel's youth right before his mother leaves the family in 1988. And he is an emotional wreck as a child. Maybe that's stating too much. But
fair.
His emotions are close to the surface, and he cries very easily. In fact, so often he's created four stages of his own outbursts.
Yeah, ranking them like you rank hurricanes, Category 1, Category 2. He doesn't know that his mom is going to leave very soon, but he can sense it, that intuitive way that children might have of knowing that something's wrong, and they're not quite sophisticated enough to know what is wrong, but something is wrong.
I'm sure he's picked up that she's had a life of dissatisfaction ever since he was a child.
Exactly. And so but he feels like he can't talk about it, because he doesn't have the vocabulary to be able to talk about that with his mom. You know, it's a much more mature and adult conversation to have. So he's worried, he's anxious, and that anxiety manifests itself as crying. He's a crybaby. He thinks of himself as a crybaby. So he has a hair trigger, and it's very, very easy for him to cry. And the worst part about it is that he hates the crying because he thinks it disappoints his mom. And so when he's crying, his mom wants to try to soothe him, but her attention to the crying is the thing that makes the crying worse.
It's like a feedback loop.
Exactly. So they're just disconnecting. You know, they're not on the same wavelength, those two. They pay a lot of attention to each other, but they're not communicating.
His father, Henry, is working in the frozen meal game.
Yeah. He has scored his dream job, Vice President of Research and Development, Frozen Foods Division. He demands that they have family time together while eating the various test market, you know, under research frozen meals that he has in his home kitchen.
Shortly before his mother leaves, he meets a kid in the neighborhood who essentially tries to murder him out in the woods on the back edge of the property. Bishop is a handful and a half.
I love Bishop. He's one of those kids that I let him do all the things I wanted to do but didn't when I was a kid. You know, he talks back to the teachers. He's smart. He's brave. He's kind of who we wish we could be, you know, at least who I wish I could have been. I was very much like a people pleaser when I was a kid, you know, like following the rules, doing exactly what the teacher said. I didn't want to get in any trouble, and I didn't want any attention on me. Bishop's the opposite. You know, he likes the attention. He craves the attention, and he wants to rebel. Yeah, the first time they meet, Samuel is out in the woods because he wants to be alone, and Bishop is waiting there to ambush anybody who might walk by, so he leaps out of a tree. This image came to me because when I was, maybe second grade, third grade, there was this kid in the neighborhood who would hide in trees and put a scary Halloween mask on and hide in a tree, and he would have like a steak knife dripping in ketchup, and he would leap out of the tree and try to scare little kids. And we all knew he was around, but yeah, thinking back on it now, it's like, what a kind of psycho thing to do. But then I used it. That's the manner in which Samuel and Bishop first meet.
And to bring us back to the young woman in the Choose Your Own Adventure, Bishop's sister Bethany, his twin sister, is the object of Samuel's affections when he's 11.
That's right. That's right. He meets her when he's 11, and he's in love with her for the next two decades or more. You know, it's one of those kind of crushes that I assume most people have. He sees her for whatever reason, something is just triggered in him, and he's not going to get over her. Kind of his whole life becomes arranged to try to kind of get in her good graces. Mostly she ignores him. She's a violin prodigy. She's doing competitions and recitals, and so she's very busy with that. And so he just kind of like hangs out around the house and hopes that she'll come out from her practice room eventually, and he'll be able to see her or talk to her.
In that position where he's in a middle-class family, and Bishop's family is much more wealthy, and you just kind of have this weird kind of vicarious access to another world.
That's right. They live in a gated community called Venetian Village. It has a kind of Italian villa theme. And he's never seen houses this big before. The kids go to private school, except Bishop has, of course, been kicked out for picking fights with the nuns and the priests. So Bishop is going to the public school where Samuel is going. So that's kind of sort of how they become friends. Six-bedroom houses, you know, panic rooms, backyard tennis courts, this kind of thing. Samuel has never seen anything like this with his dad, the frozen foods guy.
eventually we get back to the 2011 action, and Samuel has gone beyond wanting to destroy his mother in print. He wants to understand, and she's not forthcoming at all. So he does his own investigation. So he finds about her life in 1968 in Iowa. And if any of our listeners are familiar with the Law of Janta, which is the kind of the Norwegian and Scandinavian, there was a novel that came across with these rules of small societies in Scandinavia about not sticking out, not saying that you're better than other people. And that really explains a lot of Faye's father's reactions to her.
Absolutely. He immigrated to Iowa from Norway when he was 18 years old. One of the things he wants in the U.S. is to kind of go unnoticed, is to not stick out. He knows he sticks out a little bit because, you know, he's not native born. He has an accent. He doesn't exactly understand, say, baseball, you know, or at least not at first. But he wants to fit in. And then he has this daughter, Faye, who is outstanding. I mean, she's a model student, a straight-A student, the first girl in her class to ever win a scholarship. She wants to go to college, which is sort of unheard of for girls from her town. And so he's worried about it. I think he says, you know, don't tell anybody about the scholarship. It'll seem like you're bragging. And so for Faye, it's difficult because she kind of thought this whole time the point of school was to be good at it. It was a source of pride. It was something that got her recognition. But then as soon as she got a little too good at it, then the town started to turn on her. And when they heard about college, it was like, well, do you think you're better than us now? You know? So she has to fight against that. Like, does she kind of try to realize her dreams and go to college and make a different kind of life than the one her parents want for her? And that's her dilemma in that section.
And with action taking place in 1968 and seeing the cover of the book is coming, I guess, from a protest at the Democratic National Convention from 68 in Chicago, and it's called The Knicks, I'm thinking, oh, Nixon's going to pop up at some point. But The Knicks is something even more sinister, in at least in theory.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that until a friend pointed out. It's like, oh, looks like you've written a biography of Nixon, and now that's all I can see when I see the cover of the book. But no, the Knicks, it's spelled N-I-X, which I have to spell it when I say it out loud because people think maybe I've written like a basketball novel or something. So a Knicks is the name of a spirit from Scandinavian folklore. It goes by lots of different names, a neck, a nixie, a knockin. I chose nix because I like the wordplay in English. But in the Norwegian version of this story, a nix is usually depicted as a horrible, ugly troll type thing that lurks in the water. It's a spirit of the water. But sometimes it's a shapeshifter, and sometimes it will appear to children as a beautiful white horse, and it will tempt them to climb aboard. And if the kids do climb aboard, it will quickly run into the water and drown them. This is a story that Faye tells Samuel when he's a child, among several other old ghost stories. Maybe not the best story to tell an 11-year-old. He understandably pretty scared about these stories, but yeah.
Yeah, our approach toward traumatizing our children has changed a little bit over the years.
Yeah. She doesn't see anything wrong with it. And indeed, her dad didn't see anything wrong with it either, because these stories, these old folk tales, were sort of the only things he was willing to talk about life back in Norway. Everything else was a secret, but he would tell these stories.
Now, in the first half of the book, we know mostly about Samuel, and we get to see his backstory going back to 88 when his mother left. And we know his thoughts in the current 2011 time. In the second half of the novel, we get a lot of Faye, his mother's life in 1968, leading up through that time and how that affects the rest of her life. But we don't really know her current state of mind during that. And so there's a weird bit of disconnection in the second half that we don't have the insight to her current mind as we did Samuel's.
Yeah. Well, I don't think I'm giving much away that the book is sort of, I mean, it's Samuel's book and he is investigating his mother. And so his mother right now is not forthcoming with him. So all he has are these stories to the past. And so he talks to her father and talks to his own dad to try to piece things together. He talks to people that she knew in Chicago in 1968 and slowly accumulates enough information that he can tell her story. But in the present, she's still a mystery to him. And so the question at the end of the book then is will that mystery remain, or will they reconnect after he now knows this epic story that happened to her?
Now, with having two main characters like Samuel and his mother, and then four or five other secondary characters who get quite a bit of in-depth into their lives as well, three time periods. It's a really ambitious book. At any time, did you feel like you'd bitten off a bit too much in doing it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. My first draft was 1,002 pages long. Mostly that was because I just gave myself permission while I was writing to go down whatever rabbit hole I wanted to go down. Anything that seemed interesting and in some ways thematically relevant, I would just keep going. And so, you know, after the first draft, I had to cut back quite a lot, you know, 1,000. I'm not going to try to publish a 1,000-page novel. So I cut it back by a couple hundred pages, and then my editor and agent both helped me cut it back another couple hundred pages until what we hope is a very, very tight novel. But I wanted to write a book that was sprawling, that went all over the place, because I guess I realized somewhere along the way that I was going to ask people to read a very long book, and so I felt like it was my responsibility to show them an interesting time along the way. I didn't want 600 pages of all the same kind of tonal material, all of the same characters. I wanted it to be more varied and jagged than that. So yeah, lots of different time periods, lots of different places. I mean, we go from Chicago to New York City to Iowa to Iraq to Norway. I like that quality about it. I thought that it was a book that hopefully, if I did my job correctly, one wouldn't get bored reading.
On a sillier note, with a name like Guy Periwinkle, who is Samuel's editor, sounds like he could be a Thomas Pynchon character almost.
Periwinkle, the genesis of Periwinkle, in the novel, he's like the cynical publisher and media guru, you know, master image manipulator. I had sent very early drafts of the novel, maybe just, you know, 20 pages to some agents, definitely not my current one, but just others. And I got, you know, all rejections, which was fair because it was that was like 8 years ago and I had no idea what I was doing with the book. But all rejections, and a couple of the rejections were rejected on such like very like, I don't know, grounds of like marketing and consumption and consumerism. You know, like, you know, what readers want are easy books with big life lessons, you know, and things like that. And there was just so utilitarian that I invented this character based off of them. You know, I actually, some of those lines have been directly put into Periwinkle's mouth in the novel. Those agents probably would never even remember that they said that, but it's there. And it feels good to me.
But your approach has met with success because the book has sold rather well so far.
It's been pretty amazing. I wrote it mostly in secret, not because I was secretive, but mostly I was just sort of humiliating to after like 5, 6, 7 years when people ask, what are you doing? And I'd still say, I'm working on my novel. And I just imagine them saying, right, yeah, right. You know, 7 years later, still working on your book. But it took about 10 years to write. And really the only person who knew anything about it was my wife. Every few nights, read to her my new pages. And that was just our tradition. There's this fear. You work on something for 10 years and only one person has read it. You feel like you're going to be just insane, you know, that nobody will have any idea what you're talking about. So yeah, that people have been saying really nice things about it is gratifying and just kind of makes my heart clutch.
And it sells well, too.
Yeah, that's also nice. That's, you know, my publisher loves that.
So since you've given up Warcraft, how do you procrastinate nowadays?
Let's see. What do I do? I can spend way too much time on social media. I should limit myself a little bit better than I do. But I try to keep myself busy. I play a lot of tennis. I like cooking. I dawdle around the house. You know, there are a million ways to waste time in the world today. So, you know, there's never any lack, even if you don't no longer have Warcraft on your computer.
So have you started on another project?
I have, yeah. My process is a very slow one. I think maybe the reason this took 10 years to write is because I like to discover my plot along the way. I'm not really an outliner. I don't know what I'm doing before I do it. And if I do know what I'm doing before I do it, I'm sort of bored with it, you know. Right now I have some characters and I have a setting and I have maybe 50 pages of exploratory material. So I can't tell you really what it's going to be, like what the plot is, but the things that I'm thinking about, I think it's going to be a book about marriage and authenticity and gentrification and the 90s. That's about all I can say.
So how does gentrification play its way into your marriage now?
Oh, you'll have to wait for the next book to ask that question. I don't know yet.
Well, Nathan, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing the mix with us today.
Thanks for inviting me. This is really fun.
Nathan Hill is the author of the novel The Nix, which is published by Knopf. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WYPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WYPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.